Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana Elbay, and this evening we want to get some clarity on some things. We'll be talking about law and commerce. The mics will be open. We want your input, so don't hesitate to dial into the broadcast and let us know what you think about what we're discussing here this evening. The call-in number for this broadcast is 310-982-4184. That's 310-982-4184. We're going to be dealing with the following questions and much, much more. How do we act in commerce? What do we do about lawsuits? How is the monetary system set up? How do you survive law? What measures should you put in place? These are just a few of the questions that we want to answer tonight. For a business of your own and a proven way to eliminate your mortgage, student loan, and non-beneficial contracts, including the IRS, and to learn something about your art of survival, go to newdebtelimination.com. That's www.newdebtelimination.com. Don't hesitate to join us on Google Plus. Learn more about us and what we do, go to www.newdebtelimination.net. And whatever you do, make sure you catch out our Blogspot on blogspot.com. Okay? Now, I have some questions. And my first question is, a lot of people are trying to get jobs. A lot of people are filling out resumes, and you're putting all the information in there correctly. You're answering every question. You in the tell us about you section. You're very good in that, and you're sending these resumes and putting in these applications. But the people are telling you, we're not hiring. We can't hire you in all of this business. And we're constantly doing this day after day after day after day, and week after week after week, and month after month after month, and we can't get nowhere as people of African descent. What's going on? I mean, we see all these other people employed. A lot of people we see, we know doggone well, they can't even speak English. So what is it? What's happening? And I got some information that I want to bring here tonight, and actually I already pretty much knew what's going on, because, see, we have to understand that the United States of America has never been without its slaves, okay? And discrimination came in at a certain point in time, and since it has come in, it has never gone away, okay? But there was a time when discrimination as we know it did not exist. It came into existence at a certain point in time in our story. And so we want to be able to understand what's going on. But the first thing I want to get at is I want you, and you might want to try to conduct this experiment. And if you conduct this experiment, make sure that you record this stuff to the point that it can clearly be delivered to someone else to understand what you have done. Okay? And now, and what I mean by that is I want you, if you are going out and you are trying to get a job and you're sending out all these applications, write down on a separate list the people that you've sent your application resume to, and record this information, because a young lady did an experiment. And then right behind her, she was able to find out that there were blatant discriminations going on in the workplace. The United States has never been without a slave. They never stopped. Racism has never stopped. Discrimination against people of African descent has never stopped, in spite of all the talks and conversations, the meetings and rallies and marches and Supreme Court rulings, and none of that didn't make any difference when it came to these things. Now, this first little bit of information is going to last just a little while. I want you to pay very close attention to this information.
The video this week talking about black unemployment in America, where there was a sister that did a test to see if she would get hired. I'm going to go ahead and roll the clip, and I'm definitely back to talk about this one, because this really explains why a lot of black people in America don't get jobs.
An unemployed black woman pretends to be white, and the number of job offers she gets go way up. This is an interesting article on Techieville by Yolanda Spivey. Yolanda Spivey is a black woman. She was unemployed 2 years. She applied to over 300 open jobs in insurance, which is where she worked for 10 years, definitely her area of expertise and experience. She did not get a single response. She went back to college, finished her degree, applied again, wasn't getting any responses to the jobs she applied to on Monster.com. So Monster has a diversity questionnaire which asks you about your race. You can decline to disclose that. And they say it will not jeopardize your chances of getting a job. It's just kind of for informational purposes. You can't skip the question, but you can say decline to identify. So Yolanda Spivey thought, maybe that's hurting me. She goes into her Monster.com profile and she changes it to decline to identify. Isn't hearing back from anybody. She thinks of another idea. She goes back in. She creates a fake applicant named Bianca White, fills in the identical employment history, identical resume, identical education as her real self, Yolanda Spivey, changes the phone number from her home phone to her cell phone so that it can't be linked back to her original profile, and then she puts White on the diversity questionnaire. Phone call, same day. Emails, packed, same day. She gets a whole bunch of job offers in the field of insurance. In 1 week, she received 9 phone calls as Bianca White and none as African-American Yolanda Spivey. And she received 7 emails as Bianca White and only 2 as Yolanda Spivey. Both were for commission-only positions that required her to move out of state. Now, what do you think about this? I'm not surprised. When I first read about this, I said, yeah, there's a lot of individuals who want to hire specifically white people. I'm not surprised in any way.
Right.
But this is really kind of like this is an A-B test in a compelling way that really shows it's the same credentials. She just changed her name and race.
Yeah. And of course, it's probably even more possible that if she pretended to be a man, that might have gone up too, because we know that there's still a lot of bad stuff going on, inequality in that department.
I actually had a similar situation, which is I messed around with this. When I was in undergrad, I think I was a junior or something like that, in my summer of junior year, I started applying to a bunch of different jobs, and I saw this diversity question. Now, according to the U.S. Census, I'm Hispanic, right? I'm born in Argentina. My first language is Spanish. Even though my background is Eastern European Jewish and I'm completely identical genetically as to what I would be if my family came straight to the U.S. instead of to Argentina, According to the census, I'm Hispanic, and I did some testing. I made a profile where I put white, and I made a profile where I said Hispanic and identified myself as a diversity candidate. And it's very anecdotal. I don't pretend to say it was any kind of scientific study, but the results mirrored what Yolanda Spivey had here, which is that there was more interest, more callbacks, and more interviews under my white David Pakman profile. So,
yeah.
Again, completely anecdotal, but interesting that Yolanda did this.
Yeah, I think the results pretty much speak for themselves.
Did you hear what happened in that video? What this sister did? And did you see the results? This sister, underneath her own name, is saying she's a black woman, applied to 300 places. Hardly got any calls. She decides to change her name, say she's white, use the exact same credentials that she had. Didn't change nothing else but the name, her phone number, and race, so it can be linked back to her. And yet, her phone and email blows up. That's amazing. And did you hear the guy? It was the host saying he did the exact same thing. He got a bunch of calls for jobs. That tells you a lot that in America, if you say you're white, you're going to get a job. If you say you're black, or he said Hispanic, you're not going to get a call for the exact same credentials. And it proves, this little test proves how racist America is and how they try to hurt black people and also other people of color from getting a job. You can't refute this sort of stuff. And why black unemployment is so high versus white people's unemployment? It's stuff like that. Now, it's not your everyday white person you got living next door to you or going to the grocery store with. It's those who are white who own these companies and do not want to hire black people. They don't. Whatsoever. How is it this black woman takes it, the resume, the exact same resume, changed her name, changed the race, and yet she gets all these calls all of a sudden? How? How is it? This is why black people need to create their own businesses. Because as you can see, they don't want to hire us. Even if we qualify, they don't want to hire us. They only hire us because they have to, not because they want to. It's sad this sister had to change her name, say she was a white woman, just so she can get a job. Well, if that's the case, all black people need to do that. Next time you go apply for something online, say you're a white man. Say you're a white lady. Let's see if you get a job. That's sad that we got to change our race. It's time right back to what it was before desegregation and before affirmative action. It's the same thing. And now it kind of explains to me why black unemployment is so high in relation to white unemployment. Because you don't want to hire black people. Not because they're not qualified. Obviously, it's not that. Because this sister proved that if she just says she's white with the same qualifications she had before, she'll get a job. No, it's a simple fact. They don't want to hire you because you are black. This is America, and you know, I talk to people from different countries in Africa, different countries all over the world, and they say the same thing. America is one of the most racist nations in the world. They say that. They say everything in America is based on race. You do something, it's your race. You do a certain thing, it has to be something with the racial demographic of your people. Something. If you do something bad, oh, it's your race. Everything is race in this country. But people of the world need to understand that America started off on racial segregation, oppression, slavery. This is the DNA of America. It wasn't started on no spirit of brotherhood. It was started off, I'm going to oppress people, I'm going to steal from people, I'm going to kill people to get what I want. When these same group of people was leaving England from being oppressed themselves, so they could worship the way they want to worship and live the way they want to live, not get taxed so heavy and doing everything different that they feel they need to do. And yet they did the exact same thing to not only my people, they did it to the Native American people, and they did it to the Mexican people as well. But the ones who suffered the most out of all of it is my people. And to this day, we still suffer. I mean, we got to tell the truth. Unemployment is so high because it is refusal to hire. But then we always told we're lazy. We don't want to do nothing. Pull up by our bootstraps. Well, that sister was pulling her stuff up by her bootstraps. and she wasn't getting a job. Now, what could be said to this? I mean, seriously, what could be said to this? And this isn't a black show that found this. And I'm so glad it wasn't a black show that found this out. I'm so glad. I'm so glad about that. These are people who are the white man, and he would be considered a Hispanic guy, finding out the truth. And did the experiment himself about how when you're black in America, you have a hard time getting a job. Not because you're not qualified. Not because you're not experienced. But just because you're black. Welcome to America, everybody. Anyway, hit me up in the comments. Use the commentary. Subscribe to YouTube channel.
All right, Moe. We back. Now, that's kind of rough. But I do believe that every cloud have a silver lining. Just imagine. Everybody's born with an imagination. Okay. So we got this kind of stuff going on. And we got brothers and sisters out there trying to get a job. All right? Let's say that we apply for the job. And the company that we apply to, we write the name of the company down. The company contacts us and say, denied. We cannot, your application is denied, you don't fit our criteria. Okay, I don't fit your criteria. Then I put you to the side, and then I wait a week. I list myself as white. I go there, and redo the application with the same company. They send me a notice back and say, we need you to come in for an interview. Okay. So we show up with our black self. Well, we're not going to be able to hire you because we see right here on your application you say you was white. Now's the time to show him the resume that you sent to him where you was black, where he told you that your credentials didn't fit, where you was black. Before you leave, make sure you tell him to get a lawyer because he's going to need one. Okay. Now, in my opinion, I think that's an excellent remedy. Try that back two or three times. You know, I work for a company here inside the United States in my city called the Prime Osborne Convention Center. And I was the top waiter there. And I knew that the people were doing something wrong, but I couldn't put my finger on it, and I found out that what they were doing was they were stealing our gratuities. They told us that we will pay you by the hour, but you're not supposed to, all gratuities goes to the company, and it's used for this and that and the other and all this stuff, which was against the law, but we didn't know anything about law. However, there was a Mexican gentleman there. And I would see this Mexican gentleman every now and then. And there were days when we were shorthanded. And I didn't see this guy. And then again, I would see him. And then I noticed that I didn't see him anymore. And finally, one day, I seen this guy. And I was walking across the parking lot. He pulled up in a Cadillac and got out in his plain clothes, and he was going inside. And I said, hey, man, where have you been? I said, is that your car? He said, oh, yeah, that's my car. And he said, well, they have been discriminating against me. This company has been discriminating against me. I asked them for my gratuities, and they told me that they're not under any obligation to give me any gratuities. And I asked them why wasn't my name placed on the schedule, and they told me that they didn't need me, but I had other people that signed a petition to clearly show that they were shorthanded on the days you were, but I would not give an opportunity to work, so I was discriminated against. And I sent them letters explaining to my case, and I was telling them that I'm about to sue them, and they agreed to give me a check, so I'm going in here now to pick up my check. I said, well, how much is it for? He said, well, I was asking for $100,000, but they told me they'd give me $15,000 just to go away, you know, and I said, well, okay, I'll take it. And I said, well, okay. He says, and this guy told me, he says, I have had the same thing happen to me since I came to the United States. I started in California, and I've already come across to Florida, and I had to sue my way across the entire United States, and I have won every single time based on this discrimination. I say, wow. He says, so I don't worry about working. I just make sure that I'm hired, and I wait for the discrimination, and I make them pay for it. I said, well, okay, okay. And I remember that guy. And me with my dumb butt, way back then, I didn't get into the law game. Which was the best game in time, because this guy here, he, you know, everybody thought that this guy was just somebody that was there. We knew he was a foreigner or whatever, but I had no idea. I didn't even know Mexicans and all these other people were being discriminated against. I didn't know that back then. But I'm finding out now, and I learned that day. When I think back to that time, and I wish I had took the time to learn everything that I could about that at that time, and had I done that, I wouldn't be on Blog Talk Radio today. Okay? Now, what I want to get to now is I need to know what you guys think about this young lady that done that experiment, because I think that was out of sight. But in my opinion, if you do something like that and you get those results, my next question would be, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? The phone lines to dial into this broadcast is 310-982-4184. I want y'all to take on this stuff here, because this is incredible. You have to, in order to, you know, when we were going to school, I know some of you all can attest to this. We had bullies in school. And a bully is the type of person, if he knows that he can jack you around, he's going to always do it. As long as he knows that if you're going to cry and you're not going to do anything, and he can just jack you around and get away with it, he's going to do it. But the way to stop a bully is when he starts jacking you around, take him out. And the next time you see, I guarantee you, you bully everybody but you. When you see you coming, you say, ooh, I ain't messing with him. Because if I'm messing with him, I got to fight. And he ain't playing. So he ain't with the bully gang. And the bully ain't going to stop until you do that. When we was raised up, I remember my granddad came to stay with us. Blood lightning. And my mom used to be in there telling us, like, y'all don't y'all be fighting and all this right here. And I come home, and because I didn't, well, my brothers came home and talking about who hit them. I come home, my shirt be tore up and, you know, blood be on it. And they tell my boy, you bleeding? I said, that ain't none of my blood. Who blood is it? I said, I forgot his name. But anyway, my granddaddy gave me up and said, come on, boy, come on back, help me. And she come back there because my granddaddy used to live with her. And my mom come back there, what you teaching them? He said, I ain't teaching them nothing. Go back out there and shut it down. Let me hold this a minute. My granddaddy said, boy, what happened? I said, what he did? I said, he pushed me. What you did? I said, I laid him out. He said, all right, you got him. You can put a notch on a piece of paper. You ain't got to worry about him no more. So, when these people roll you, never, ever, ever say, I'm just going to let it go. No. You got to be joined at the hip to these people. They got to know that when they do this, they always got to fight. There's always going to be a repercussion. I guarantee you that'll stop them. All we need is, if you get in any city, I would say, we'll take New York City, for instance. If we got 300 people out of all the hundreds of thousands of people in New York City, if we get 300 people that say, I'm not using no driving license, I got a right to travel, I'm going to send all my documentation down to the sheriff's department, I'm going to get out there on the road, and I'm going to exercise my right to travel. And when they roll me, I'm going to sue them. So we got 300 people are prepared to sue, and a quarter of them already suing. What you think going to happen? The bullet going to change his plan. He going to change his plan. He got no choice. That's too much, man. You can take, in some little small town, you can take 25 or 30 people, black and white, you, Gentile, Protestant, Catholic, short, fat, tall, skinny, green, purple, and blue. Pull it off. I guarantee you they're chain gear. That's how you stop a bullet. You gotta deal with them. And this is something that we have not been doing. We have been victims of circumstances. We have not done what it takes. We are afraid to fight for what's right. See, public policy is not law. Law is law. And it just so happens inside the United States, on contract, the Constitution of the United States is the supreme law, especially in the face of public policy. And you use that if you want to. But what I recommend is that you formulate your documentation and master how to use that. So, and the pen is mightier than the sword. You'll discover that when you start using it. And if you learn how to do it right, boy, look here, let me tell you something. You got it going on. Now, I want to look at something else here this evening, but I'm going to take a commercial break. If anybody got any questions, go ahead and raise your hand. I will open up the line and let you in. 310-982-4184. Let me know what you think about this kind of thing. Now, if you think there's another way to do it and I'm wrong, let me know. You know, hey, man, we talk about things over here at this place.
Freeing up capital to make investments may not be as hard as you think. For those of you who have Facebook accounts, send me a friend request over there on Facebook and LinkedIn to Tahaka Amana Elbay. That's T-A-R-A-H-A-K-A. Amana is A-M-A-A-N-A and then E-L and, of course, B-E-Y. And you'll be able to see the actual documents clearly showing you how I was able to cancel my mortgage and property taxes contracts, and that way I have freed up capital for investments. To get the apparatus to do this with, go to www.newdebtelimination.com. That's www.newdebtelimination.com. It's not as hard as you think. Send a friend request on Facebook, and I'll grant that request so you can actually see the documents for yourself. Peace.
All right, I'm back. Now, I'm going to look at another little short, quick situation, because in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, well, first of all, before I give you my opinion, I'm going to run this and stuff so you can hear it. And then you let me know what you think. Boy, it's hard for me to keep from giving my opinion on this, because I looked at this situation, and I have to disagree with the guy that put this stuff out. You know, I really do. I have to disagree with that. You know, I ain't going to say no more than that. I'm going to run this right here. And after we get through, y'all let me know what y'all think about this here little piece right here, okay?
The main problems I've always had with Michael Jordan is that he's never done any charity work in the black community. He's never done any activism. He's always been a selfish person. I think when you got that type of money and power, I think you have an obligation to give back to your community. One of the things I respect about LeBron James has always been involved in the black community. He's always been doing charity work. He's always been involved in activism. During the Trayvon Martin murder, LeBron spoke out against the injustice. He spoke out against George Zimmerman. He even helped rally some of the rallies during the trial. This is something that Michael Jordan would have never done. Michael Jordan has never got involved in activism. And I think when you have that type of money and power, that's extremely selfish to not get involved in the activism in your own black community. That's why some people have called Michael Jordan and Uncle Tom, because he's never done anything for black people in the black community. I'm not going to take anything away from him as a basketball player. We all know he was a great basketball player, but off the court, he's never done anything to help his own community. The same thing with O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson may have been a great football player, but off the court, he never did any activism in the black community. So I put Michael Jordan in the same category as O.J. Simpson. I put him in the same category as Barry Bonds, because these are the certain type of black athletes that don't give a damn about the black community, that don't give a damn about black people. And LeBron James is the complete opposite of that. That's what I've always respected about LeBron James.
Every time a pair of Jordans comes out, black people start acting a fool. They will fight each other over a pair of shoes. They will kill each other over a pair of shoes. It makes no logical sense. I know some black people that don't even got a car, and they will spend $200 on a pair of Jordans. It makes no sense. Black people need to start looking at what's important and what's not so important. It only costs $5 to make Jordans overseas, and he's selling them for $200 in the U.S. Michael Jordan is laughing at black people. And most black people are so ignorant, we don't even realize it. This is why I will never buy a pair of Jordans, and I never have bought a pair of Jordans. Black people need to wake up and look at reality. Stop idolizing these material things. These material things don't mean anything. If you're willing to fight over a pair of shoes, you are a damn fool. When I see these news reports showing crowds of black people fighting over shoes, it's embarrassing. Because they're making all black people look bad. Every time white people look at the news and they see all this ignorance, these crowds of black people fighting over a pair of shoes, this makes us all look bad. This gives them all they need to stereotype all black people. This is why we got to wake up and realize that Michael Jordan doesn't give a damn about us, so we shouldn't give a damn about Michael Jordan.
We begin with stampedes and scuffles today at shopping malls around the nation. People are clamoring for the release of the Air Jordan 11 as an athletic shoe, but only a limited number are available, and it's leading to scenes of unruly crowds. Police in North Carolina had to break up fights at a mall while people waited to buy the shoes. This was just before dawn. When mall doors opened, crowds of people pushed their way in. And outside the Foot Locker store on the second floor, some shoppers started jumping the line while others at the back surged forward. And shoppers rushed the entrance of a mall in Indianapolis, Indiana. Some people's shoes fell off. Others fell down in the mad rush and then got run over by the crowd. The front doors of the mall were ripped off the hinges. Here in Northern California, problems developed at several malls, including Hilltop in Richmond, where 2,000 people turned out, only to be turned away when gunfire rang out and the sale was called off. Gil Diaz is in Richmond with the very latest. Gil?
Hi, Grace. Good afternoon. Yeah, we're standing outside Hilltop Mall. It officially opened at 10 o'clock this morning. I just spoke with the Richmond police. Now, they say that the stores or the shoe stores that carry the Air Jordans at this mall are supposed to start selling them again this noon. That's if they have any. Now, the reason they're selling them at noon is because they stopped selling them around 6:30 this morning when an alleged gunshot went off on that crowd. But everything is okay now. But no one imagined, no Northern California mall, not even the workers themselves, thought that this would get out of hand this much. But you know what? As you can see here, we've also seen that a lot of shoppers are still here. I haven't been able to ask them whether they've been able to grab or nab their Air Jordans. But a lot of them are doing their last-minute Christmas delivery. But you know, even though this opened at 10 o'clock, those 2,000 woke up around midnight, coming out here at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, fighting the crowds, fighting the police, fighting the security mall just to nab a pair of shoes. Now, like you mentioned, Grace, this is a retro black patent leather white shoes that is supposed to be a limited edition, and some of these stores don't even have enough for everyone to go around. And here's the chaos that happened earlier today. This is what the hype is all about. Limited edition retro white and black patent leather Air Jordans.
I had to get them for somebody, you know. If I can't have them, then my brother can have them then.
The $180 shoes are so hot, some shoppers decide to wait more than 6 hours in line in the frigid temperatures just to nab a pair.
First, we went to Hillsdale Mall. Okay. There was 150 people out there, 36 pairs. 36 they gave us a number, and it's going to be a raffle. That's some bull.
The demand became too intense at some shopping malls, like the Webbertown Mall in Stockton, where crowds squeezed through doors. At the Bayfair Center in San Leandro, a rowdy crowd of 200 people broke down the entrance doors. In San Bruno, at the shops at Tan Foran, police forced crowds to back up and form a single line after some people pushed and shoved their way to the front.
This is how the line is supposed to look, and it wasn't looking like that earlier. It was, you know, bunched up. Everybody was in. Yeah, everybody was in a bum rush.
At the Hilltop Mall in Richmond, where police say about 2,000 people gathered outside, an alleged gunshot went off.
And out of nowhere, we just hear a pop. And there was, like, cops all over the floor, like, guarding people.
Until the cops started running over to a guy and get that gun.
That incident forced mall personnel to stop selling the shoes, which infuriated the crowd even more.
Everybody was looking for a entrance to go in.
No one was hurt during the incident, but a suspect is reportedly in custody. All of this turmoil over a pair of shoes.
Hey, this is yours.
As for that gunshot outside this mall, I just spoke with Richmond police. They do confirm it was a gunshot. Some people thought it was just firecrackers going off, but it was a gunshot. No one was hurt. They do have a 24-year-old Richmond man in custody. He did have that gun, and it was not registered to him. Grace.
Gil, I notice a lot of younger people buying these shoes. Do any of them even remember when the first pair came out 15 years ago?
You know, that's a funny question, because I know a lot of these people were teenagers. A lot of them saying, when I was younger, I used to have these shoes. And I'm thinking, you're probably 2-3 years old. But yeah, you know, even though Michael Jordan isn't even playing ball yet, I guess a lot of them, no matter how old you are, consider him the greatest basketball player ever.
They'll always be fans. All right. Thanks a lot, Gil.
All right, now, what y'all think about that? Man, say Michael Jordan don't do nothing for the black community. He don't do this. He don't do that. Okay, everybody. We've just launched our new website. It's www.newdebtelimination.com. That's newdebtelimination.com. You can click on the navigational links up top. There's the home link, the services link, the donation page link is there as well.
When you get ready to own your own business, for those of you who own your own business or want to own your own business, there's a link available up top for that. Also, all of the previous audios that we've done on our wealth building classes, so click on the wealth building class link for all your previous audio. You can go in anytime you get ready, and as we go along, we'll add our new audio plugs under that title, the wealth building class link. Okay, www.newdebtelimination.com.
Okay, now I had to go to that quick commercial because my phone blimp knocked me off the air. But I'm back now. But let me go back to talking about what I was saying here. I want to know, where is it written that when any man gets rich, he's obligated to do something for his community? Where is that written? Now, I know that to make transformation from boy to man, the first thing you're going to have to do is get the power. As a result of getting the power, then you get the money. Once you got the power and the money, now you're officially ready to get the girl. You set your eyes towards your community, your city, your state, and then eventually your nation, and then finally set foot off the continent. Now, this has just so happened to have been the characteristics of men down through the years. But I still think that nobody is obligated to do anything because of who they are. I don't believe that. That's not my opinion. I believe that if a man is rich, he should decide whether or not he want to do anything or give anybody anything. That's his prerogative. And for this guy to say that I'm not going to buy an elder in our community, my question is, how much does he owe you? I mean, if the NBA was selling tickets and you purchased a ticket to go in and watch the guy play, you bought the ticket, you got what you wanted, you were paid in full. If you bought a television and we broadcast it, the media broadcast the basketball game across the news, across the media, and you watch the man perform, you have been paid in full. So now I want to know, where is the contract that says after that he's obligated to give you something? Where? You see. And the reason why I gathered that little tidbit and put that out there is because I have ran into that over and over and over again, personally. I was selling movies. Okay. Now, the store was selling movies. Inside the store was selling older movies at outrageous prices, and people were going in the stores and purchasing the movies and bringing the movies out and playing the movies, and after they watched the movie, they threw it to the side. It has no more value. But nobody went to the store and told the store, and hey, man, you know, I've been buying movies from you for a long time. You need to give us up. You owe me something. You're obligated to do something in our community because me and thousands of other people who look like me have made you rich. So now you are obligated to do something for our community. I haven't seen it. However, when I was selling movies, the brothers would come by, and every week or every time there's a new movie come out, they'd come in there, buy two or three movies, and spend $10 or $20. And after they do that a few times, they come back, man, you don't never give me nothing, man. I said, I'll give you exactly what you paid for. Yeah, but, if I paid it now, you ought to just throw a brother a little something every night. I never understood that mentality. I never did. If I have a product and you purchase the product, there's an even exchange. I'm trying to figure out where, how is it that I owe you something else? or that I have to give you something. Then I had the crew, brother come up, him and his wife, and, hey, man, we just left church. I said, well, good for you. In a Escalade, they dressed to kill. He got diamonds all across his face. Man, give me some of the movies you got, man. I said, how many you want to buy? Oh, man, we ain't got no money. I told you we just came from church. I said, well, hey, man, I don't understand it. That. I mean, what does that have to do with me and the products that I have to sell? Oh, man, you go way back, man. I can't believe this here, man. I said, you ever bought movies out of Walmart? Yeah, I bought plenty of movies out of Walmart. How much did you tell him he ought to give you? Man, that's not the point. Well, what is the point, brother? That's all right, bro. That's all right. That's all right, you know. God watching. God. That is one of the most amazing things that I've ever seen. And I'm trying to figure out how a people that's been labeled as Negro, colored, and black hope to survive as a nation of people when they are constantly refusing to patronize one another and at the same time expecting each other to give you something and get deeper in poverty. Can anybody explain that type of brain to me? Help me out. The number to call in is 310-982-4184. Maybe I'm making a mistake. Maybe you see it a whole different way. But I'm trying to figure out, because in my opinion, this is what I think. In my opinion, I think that people of African descent should always patronize each other, and it should be against our own personal law for us to ever expect each other to give each other anything, not in the position and condition that we're in today. And if you purchase something from me and I give you a product, what I expect you to do is to patronize everybody else that's like me, that look like you. Don't take your money and send it out of your community. Keep it in your community. Keep it among your people. Patronize each other. But if a man is expecting you to give him something when you are in business, how will you stay in business by giving stuff away? Two, take away one, leave one. You can't survive that. And this is part of why we're in the condition that we're in. As soon as we see each other, we want a discount. Is it any way you ain't got no system set up where, you know, I could just pay you a little bit at a time? And you got a big shiny Cadillac sitting outside. What kind of thinking is that? And I mean, I can understand if it was in the law. But what we're doing is the people that we should be asking to give us some, we don't ask them nothing. We don't ask them. You walk to Walmart, or Kmart, or Sears, or any store, price up there, $199.99 plus tax. We go spend cash money for it, and smile and giggle and with the clerk, and I buy stuff here all the time, man. You know, I think this is a good quality product. Yeah, sure is. Yeah, this is good. Well, I got one at the house. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to come back and get this thing over here, too, man. I need a microwave. My wife, she came last week and got a phone. You know, we sure love giving you our money, you know. Well, let me add the tax in. The tax will be another $40. That's all right. Put it on that. But you go to your poor brother who's struggling, trying to make it. Bro, you ain't, man, you all good, man, you know. This is amazing. Now, if I'm wrong, the phone lines are open. You can open up, raise your hand, and I open up the lines so you can get in and and point out to me, and I'll listen to every word you got to say if I'm wrong. Who knows? Maybe what I'm saying don't even exist. I had a man one time. He told me I owe him something. I didn't even know who he was. I had got off of work one day because I was working for a Caribbean restaurant, and I managed the restaurant, and I had to travel through downtown late at night with my little tips in my pocket and all of this stuff. And by the time I get home, it's daybreak. And this guy, he's standing out there on the porch with all the drug dealers, and he told me, hey, man, you're going to pay me my money you owe me. And I looked down there because I wonder who he was talking to. You know, I thought he was probably talking to somebody across the street. And when I lived there, I'm talking to you. I said, you talking to me? He said, yeah, I'm talking to you. Like I said, you're going to pay me my money. I said, brother, I ain't got no money. I read behind my coat. I said, brother, I ain't got nothing but this 9mm. That's all I got. Everybody on the porch disappeared. He's scared. He's scared to move. He said, man, I'm sorry. I thought you was somebody else. I said, oh, okay, no problem, brother. I'm sorry. You're a mistaken identity. That could happen. And I went on about my business. But needless to say, every time I go back and forth then and get off of work, it'd be like a ghost town up there. There'll be no more drug dealers. Nobody. Right, no more. You know, all this kind of foolishness among each other. We had to do all that. Ain't nobody obligated to give you nothing. If a man is a brother and he get rich, he's not obligated to give you anything. If he has a product to sell and you purchase the product, you purchase it from him just like you purchase it from anybody else. We got to get away from this type of condition of thinking that if I patronize my brother, he got to give me something because I patronize him. Well, what about the fact that you purchased the product and he gave you the product and it was an even exchange? When is it that he is obligated to give you something? And we had the same thing going on between the brothers and the sisters. If I, the sisters got this thing, if I go to bed with you, you owe me. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. I always thought that an even exchange, you know, where is it written? Show me the contract where if a sister have sex with a man, he and there's an even exchange because they're giving each other what each other want or need, that the brother owes her some more money. The money. Where? How? The phone line's open. 310-982-4184. Come on in here. Tell my role. What is that written at?
If I need a man, then he, you know, we gonna have to date for at least 2 months before I have sex with him.
Why? What are you supposed to be doing in the meantime? Taking you out to dinner, buying a dinner, taking you to the movie, spending for that, all this stuff. What? Where is it written? The only thing I'm asking for is for you to show me where it's written. Where is the contract? Where? Now, let's take a look at this right here. Okay, we're going to deal with this, and then I'll be right back. And I know y'all probably busy. That's why y'all ain't raised y'all hand right now. Y'all probably busy. I know y'all can't wait to get back to the phone, to open up the phone line, and point out to me where I lied at. All right, hold on. Just for a second, and we're going to be right back.
Wait, who you calling Wee? This is my hair. I bought this hair. I paid for this hair, and I still got the receipt.
African-American women spend billions every year on black hair products, even though they only make up 10% of the American population. They buy 70% of all wigs and extensions purchased here in the United States.
It's very important. They take their last dime to get their hair done. They go hungry before they let their hair go to look bad.
My journey into the world of black hair begins in Oakland, California, at the Black Hair Extravaganza.
throw our hands together. Somebody say, Aretha Franklin.
When you look at her, it's like her crown. She's a queen. You know, so she needs like extra pieces and braids and big hair. It's like a crown.
I just feel, you know what I'm saying, your hair important. If your hair messed up, you feel me, brothers ain't gonna try to get at you, you ain't females gonna knock you, you feel me? Basically, you gotta have your hair tight.
What? And for the sisters, we represent the
sisters.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
Come on.
Come on, Ronnie. Show them what you made out of, baby.
We express our beauty. In fact, the Bible speaks to us about our hair being a treasure. So it's just something we've always kept in our culture.
But with that huge market, who controls it? Where does the money end up? Where do the billions go? I decided to try to find out here at the Black Hair Extravaganza. Follow the money.
Thermal misses for your heat style. Oh, you never do
okay.
That?
It's awesome.
Step 3. Apply the thermal straightening ball. Section the hair into...
We think the African-American style is a very big business.
Almost every week, because they change the style for hair.
Everybody wants to be a part of our market because we're the number one consumer. We spend 10 to 1 on anybody in hair. In the retail market right now, majority of the retail stores are ran by Koreans. And more of the Korean stores that are ran by, the 90%, are supported 100% by Black African money. It's so unfair, you know, that they take our money. But once again, part of it is our blame. We allow what happens.
Is this true that the Koreans dominate the black hair industry? What you're looking at is one of the Black Beauty Supply magazines that inform people who are interested in black hair products. All the ads and articles are about African Americans and their hair. And even though all the information is about blacks, half of this magazine is in Korean. Magazine Beauty Times, which is the number one publication for black beauty store owners, is written entirely in Korean. It's here, inside Beauty Times, that I spot Dr. Tony Leno, a black hair expert who writes a monthly column for this magazine, a column which not even he can read. I contact him and he invites me to Los Angeles to learn more about the Southern California black hair industry.
Now where we are now, this is the famous Crenshaw Corridor, where most of the many elite black businesses are.
And right here on the corner of 54th and Crenshaw, South Central Los Angeles. This is beautiful wigs. This is a Korean-owned hair store. They sell hair of all kinds.
In your store here, what percentage of your business is Afro-American?
About 100%. 99.9.
Okay.
Okay.
In other words,
99.9.
Okay. And up here on these walls right here, these racks, all the way around, are the hair that's used for weave and for extensions.
Janet Jackson, they come over here, pick it up, you know, virgin human hair. Vivica Fox, I saw her in several weeks, and I cut inside for her. I've been knowing him a long time.
Okay.
Richard Pryor.
Yeah, that little Richard.
Yeah.
This city alone only had 10 beauty supply stores 20 years ago. Now there are over 100 Korean-owned beauty supply stores. Oh, you're looking at a typical beauty supply store, Korean-owned beauty supply store, but all these products have one common denominator. They are all aimed at the Afro community. One of the things that the Koreans are doing now, and they predicted this themselves back in 1999, and it's happening now, since they control 80% of the distribution of Afro hair care products, especially professional products that are sold in beauty supply stores only, it only stands to reason they can control what gets distributed. They are creating their own line of products or buying out existing black-owned companies. I don't see a reversal of this at all. It's just getting deeper and deeper.
With the Koreans controlling the retail and wholesale distribution, they are slowly making inroads into taking over the black manufacturers.
We're going to Kazuri Products. They are a black-owned manufacturer of hair care products with specialized primarily in curling irons, pressing combs, and the stove heaters that you heat the irons up in.
This is Lucky White, who owns Kazuri along with her husband.
We have been in business for over 30 years, and we are a black company selling to black beauty supplies and also to black hairstylists, and we make a quality product. Everyone look at our product as being the best in the industry. However, since the Asians have been here, they are cutting us out, telling us that our product is not in demand any longer. The Korean connection. About 3 years ago, they started to blacklist our product. As they brought their own products in, they started to manufacture curling irons, and they duplicate everything that you manufacture. They were duplicated, and then they start to slowly cut back on orders, and then they tell you that your product is not in demand. So they would make something that's very similar that looked like ours, and then they try and sell the consumer on this product.
Can you show me some products from Kazuri?
Kazuri?
Kazuri products.
This is Kazuri, folks.
This is all Kazuri.
This is an A1.
So you have maybe three Kazuris, and then the rest.
This Kazuri, this A1 product, this Stella.
Stella.
Yeah.
Who makes Stella?
You know, they are B-sale, the wholesalers.
And they make this product.
Actually, they make a copy, you know, for the other brand, you know, like Kizuri, like A+. But their brands, you know, they are no good quality.
Not good quality.
No, just copy for the others.
They are really trying to shut us out of the industry.
They're telling you they will no longer distribute your product in these stores?
They tell us that our product is not in demand any longer. But that's just a excuse not to purchase our products.
This is actually a T-bumper by Kazuri. I use it all the time.
This is The Place to Be, a black hair salon in San Jose, California.
Kazuri products are much in demand. We use them here. We have a setup here. We also have one here. We use their spritz as well. We use their whole lineup, so they are in high demand.
We have to look at saving our community as well as saving this industry. We are a nation within this nation, and we've just given everything away, and we cannot do that any longer. We have to stand up and fight. We are beautiful black people. If we have to wear our hair short, so be it. Let's wear it short, but let's get this under control where we control the industry and not let someone else come in and then set up and take all our revenue out of the community.
But can Mrs. White and other black manufacturers fight back against this? New Star Beauty Supply, the largest wholesaler of black beauty supplies on the West Coast. New Star also manufactures their own products for sale to the ethnic market. Mr. Moon is manager of New Star.
You are the number one biggest the ethnic the distributor.
In the West Coast?
Yes.
You guys are?
Mm-hmm. We trying to like one-stop buying now. Like.
We took them as being a friend, and that they would not come in and try and take over the whole industry, but that's what they have done. They got in, now they control it, and they are really, boasting about it, and they are talking about it, and then they are laughing at us all the way to the bank.
Thank you.
How do the Korean retailers get the money to start up these beauty supply stores? To find out, I traveled to the University of California at Berkeley and spoke with Professor John Lee.
Many of the ones that started recently came from South Korea that was much more enriched. So by selling their farm or by selling their apartment, they could have this initial pot of money to start relatively small businesses in urban areas. Furthermore, they had encouragement, sometimes quite explicitly, in terms of funding by relatives, friends, and other sorts of religious or whatnot networks to provide them with money to start their business. So it's fair to say that there are all sorts of formal and informal means by which Korean Americans and South Korean business people dominate the market and are implicitly unwilling to let competition challenge their dominance.
So the two magazines, they're all in Korean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does that seem like fair business practice?
Yeah, well, as I said before, this is one of the mechanisms by which Koreans, South Koreans and Korean American merchants ensure the domination of the market.
It's OTC.
Later, I learned that what we're seeing now, the Korean domination of the black hair industry, had its start back in the early 60s with the help of both the Korean government and the United States government. This is Chosun, one of the most respected newspapers in South Korea. And it's inside the archives of this newspaper that I discovered a document from 1965 in which the wig manufacturers in Korea convinced the Korean government to ban the export of raw hair, making it impossible for anyone to manufacture wigs from the highly desirable Korean hair population, except for the Korean manufacturers themselves. And 6 months after the Korean ban on the export of hair, the United States government banned the import of any wig that contained hair from China. This ban on Chinese wigs virtually locked in the wig business for these South Korean merchants. So it seems that what we're seeing today, the Korean domination of the black hair industry, had its start with the help of both the Korean and the United States government almost 40 years ago.
You blow the whistle on what's going on just like we are discussing now and inform people. They'll be surprised and delighted, too.
Well, I think people are informed, but, I mean, black people as a whole, they just don't have much unity as Koreans do or any other race. You just doesn't have much unity. As a whole, we don't stick together.
Well, you know, this is a new millennium, and people, if they look at the past, and perhaps they can deduce from that they can change the future
based on
the past.
They can. But the young people have to be enlightened. The black dollar needs to be spent with your black people as much as possible.
We kind of take each other for granted sometimes, but I think when things like this happen, we always seem to come together like other tragedies. And, you know, human nature allows us to
do that. We can come together for human tragedies, but when it comes down to the almighty dollar, that's not the case. They did not seem to pull together for the dollar.
Denny's Restaurant, Oakland, California. Here, members of the black beauty supply industry in Northern California have gathered to discuss the Korean domination of their industry and the possibility of creating an organization to take back the black hair industry.
Now, we used to have a total monopoly on this beauty business. Now we've lost. It's only about two or three of us in Oakland now, and it used to be nothing but us in Oakland purchasing these products.
Most of the beauty supplies in the Bay Area, Korean beauty supplies, they have organizations. Mm-hmm. And their organization, most of the time, they tell who to sell and who not to sell. Mm-hmm. Like 5 years ago or 4 years ago, when Microyaki was so popular and so hot, they wouldn't sell to me. Yeah. And the reason they wouldn't sell to me is like glamorous, and Ebony told them not to sell. And sometimes we used to order through Ahmed, you know, Lake Mary Beauty uh-huh. Supply.
Because they don't think you're black.
They don't think you're black. The Koreans don't think you're
no,
black.
No, I mean, when they call me, they think that, you know, I'm a Korean store. You know?
Are you black or Asian? How do you feel about that? Are you black or Asian? I was like,
that's crazy.
What does that have to do with me purchasing a product from you?
So, since they can't sell it to us, why we can't sue them? We have people that are able to get these hair products.
Right, right.
I think that's where we need to start. And then we go to the next level. Because if they don't want to sell to you, they will figure out a way not to sell to you. A lawsuit will just make them even stronger, stronger wills about it.
The way I'm looking at it, if you walked into Macy's, discriminated against you, what would you do?
Well, you know what, it's a whole different world. Okay.
If you don't tell me nothing, I'm going to keep doing it.
Okay. Lawsuit may get the attention. Bad publicity may get the attention, but you know what will get the attention?
Money.
If your money does not go to them and it goes to somebody else, and then once you start giving money, you start swaying the way they think.
Just a few months.
Okay, Moses, we're back. The last speaker gave the solution. That's it. I mean, it ain't hard to figure out. I wish it was possible for you all to meet the women that I have dated in my past life. I mean, my past life, that I date, you know, that I am seen in public with. All of them got their own hair. Otherwise, they ain't with me, period. I do not want a woman with chemicals in her hair, a perm, definitely not in a weave. I went to a medical center. One day I had to deliver some products to this little place. And when I got there and I walked inside, I seen that 100% of the women that I seen inside this facility were women of African descent. And I stood there and I waited on the clerk to come and take a little order so I can drop off the packages and get in my truck and go away. I was delivering medical supplies. And the sisters was all over the place. And I was looking around, and, I mean, they was all over everything. One sister walked up to me. She said, "You look like you confused." I said, "Well, why you say that? You don't know which one of us you want." I say, "Well, I'm afraid I have already made up my mind about that." She said, "You have?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, which one do you like?" I said, "Well, actually, all of you look nice, but I can't date any one of y'all." She said, "And why is that?" I said, "Because everybody in here, most of what I see, have somebody else's style of hair on their head. I don't see anybody with their own natural hair on their head they was born with without a perm in it." She looked at me. She said, "Okay, I'll be back." And she went and told the rest of the girls what I said, and they come and peep around the corner, and one of them say, "Well, he does look nice, but I don't care what he says. I'm going to wear what I want to wear." I said, "Well, that's all right, sister. That's your prerogative." "Well, so you just don't date no woman if she ain't got her own hair." I said, "That's right." I said, "That's my prerogative." "Well, ain't nothing wrong with that." I said, "But I will be back up there." She said, "Well, you come on back. We're going to be back here. But we ain't changing our hair." I said, "Well, that's okay. You don't have to. You don't have to do nothing you don't want to do. I'll see you later." So that's my take on that. I've seen some beautiful sisters, but the first thing I look at is dead in her face, and I look at her hair and stuff like that, and I keep it moving. But it's totally up to you. This hair business inside the United States, I mean, these people have come from another land. The only customers they have is you. Just you. I don't see no Koreans going in no hair store and spending no money to get no hair. I don't see no Mexicans. I don't see no Chinese. I don't see no Caucasians. I don't see nobody going in there but you. Yes, you. Common sense tell me that I don't have any more complaints about my economic condition. You don't have no more complaints. Because all you have to do is stop buying it. Just like the Asian lady just told you, just stop buying it. You know, you stop buying it, where the customers? They got no more customers. So what got to happen then? They got to close the door. Now, brothers, y'all can help the sisters out. I mean, you know, I hear sisters all the time say, I'm looking for a real man. But she got on weave. She got on her beautiful black skin. She got on makeup. She got on eyelashes. She got eyeshadow. A whole nother face. But I'm looking for a real man. And my question is, for what? What are you going to do with him? I mean, if 99.9% of you is fake, what are you looking for something real for? For what? I got to go get my nails done. Well, me personally, nothing turns me on better than a woman that gets out the bathtub and I can see her natural feet with her natural toes. I love that. You come in and I got to stop laughing at all this business here. And I'm laying in the bed with you and I smell these chemicals on your fingers and it smells like some kind of, what you call that stuff? Furniture cleaner. Hold on, I got a line with somebody with a hand raised. Area code 678.
Tyler Perry Pleasant.
Okay, he's busy. All right. If you got a question or comment, go ahead and raise your hand. The number to dial in is 310-982-4184. I'll open up the line, and you can let me know what you think about this. Because, this, you know, I'm just letting you know how I see it. You know, I am not interested in a sister that doesn't have her own hair and that's not natural. That's what I want. And now, if a sister is telling me, well, look, because I had a sister one time. She come over, she had her hair done up, boy, and she had one of them kind of hairdo where it looked like somebody pasted some waves in her hair. And it looked like I would need a hammer and chisel in order to run my fingers through her hair. And she said, do you like my hair? I said, no. She said, well, I do. I said, well, okay. I mean, you asked me a question, I gave you an answer. And we sat around. She said, I want to get in the bed and go look at TV. I said, well, come on back there, get in there. I said, the remote right there on the bed. You ain't coming? I said, nope. So after a little while of that, being back there, she got on there, opened up the door. When I'm going home, I said, okay, let me open the door. You ain't got to open the door. I opened the door myself. I said, well, leave the gate open when you get out there. Leave the gate open. Why did you leave the gate open? Because another woman might want to come in. But anyway, then the sister come back with the same hairdo. I let her in. She said, you have them here? I said, sure I do. Yeah, I was kind of courteous and stuff. But she ended up leaving again. She never come back again. But anyway, in my opinion, and this is just my personal, every man has his personal preference. You see, every man does. And so if you have your own personal preference, that's what you like. And you need to be honest with yourself about what you like. If you like, because see, a lot of men, they love weave. I really believe they do. And they love the hairy woman with European style hair hanging down her back and with her nails all done up and with a whole new face and all that. And they walk with it. And these brothers walking with it. They proud. But that's his preference. You know, so I can't condemn him. That's what he likes. It doesn't have anything to do with what I like. I already know what I like. And you see. So I think, brothers, if you get with the sisters, I think the sisters need to ask you guys, well, what kind of woman you like? You need to be honest with her and explain to her exactly what you like. If you like a woman, I like a woman with long, luxurious hair, whether it's hers or not. I like the woman to have her nails done with paint on them. I like her to put on her makeup. If that's what you like, you need to let her know that. Okay? Now, if that's not what you like, then you need to let her know exactly what it is you do like. But don't let the sister come in there and lead her false pretenses that you like that, but then you're more attracted to a natural woman out there, and you with her and spending money for her to get her what she likes. She's under the impression that you like it. But then every time you see a natural woman come by with a fro, and it's nice and trimmed and hooked up, and she's nice and shapely, and she got a natural nails, the one she was born with, and a natural feet, and you just done fell natural bone in love with her, but at the same time you led this other woman to believe that you like that over there. Don't do the sister like that. Be honest with the sister. Be honest with you. I have been on dating sites. I've seen some beautiful sisters on there. But the only one that had my attention is the one with the real hair. I'm the only one. The rest of them, I think you're wonderful, but adios. That's just me. That's just the way I see it. Now, I'm going to look at understanding the game, because we got to get some real things right. We're dealing with law and commerce, and this is what we're talking about. And everything that we're discussing now plays out in law and commerce. It really do. It really do. It plays out in law and commerce. Everything that we're discussing here this evening. So we're going to look at understanding the game. No holds barred. Just bumping his seatbelt, going on and digest.
When the system no create no job, what you expect get some youth we have? Them we kill people and rob. Yeah.
Consequently, a black child in America is born at dead zero. And he has to now compete with a white child who has 87% what he needs to succeed. And I hear people saying, well, a black child, y'all just not doing it right. That's why our white kids are out achieving. No, it's because he got everything he needs. You don't have anything. That's why he's out achieving you. That's why you go drive around this city, any other city, and look at all the big skyscrapers, the big tall buildings. You go across America, and if you find five blacks in the United States that own a building with more than three stories, you're lucky. You don't own and control anything. Where are your airplanes and ships and boats? Where are your industries? You don't manufacture anything. All you're doing is consuming. We are 100% consumers and zero producers in the most capitalistic society on earth. And we have failed to understand because of our marketing people have not told us the truth. Our promoters have not told us the truth that in a capitalistic society, there is no such thing as consumer power. Consumer power does not exist. You cannot have consumer power in a capitalist society. The only person that has the power is he who is producing has the power. Therefore, you have producing power. You don't have any consumer power. Consumerism is a weakness. Consumerism comes from the word to consume. Consume means to be eaten up, to be eradicated, to be eliminated, to be erased. And prior to the 1950s in this country, when a black person got tuberculosis, you said he had consumption, which means he's being eaten alive by the disease. And here we are bragging about our consumer power. Go look at all the black magazines bragging about black consumer power. We don't have any consumer power. That's a weakness. We should be talking. That's like going into a black neighborhood and having a crack addict bragging about how much crack he consumes. And he's got crack power. It's the addict that's selling him the crack that's got the power. I mean, the crack, the drug dealer. It's the drug dealer who's producing the drugs and selling it to him. He's the one that has the power. But we never seem to can get it right. And so we live in a society where we don't understand what the game we're playing in, and we're losing. We don't understand the game because we haven't been taught the game. We don't even understand something simple like racism. I keep telling black folk what racism is. I go around the world and I ask blacks in various countries. I said, two people, stand up any place in the room. I'll give you $1,000 if you can tell me what racism is. I've never, ever had one that knew what racism was. Never had one. I said, what is racism? He said, well, it's bigotry. It's hatred. It's not getting along with people. It's bias. It's discrimination. All that wrong. Racism has nothing to do with getting along with people and liking people. Racism is a competitive relationship between groups of people who are competing for the ownership and control of resources, wealth, and power. That's what racism is. Racism never existed on the earth until the 1500s, when all of a sudden 9 European nations decided to use black labor, black bodies, and black wealth out of Africa to get in a race. After Columbus had discovered America, supposedly, in quotes, in 1495, all of a sudden they're going to rush to redevelop the Western world. So all these countries were in a race, a contest, competing to see who can develop North America, Central America, and Latin America. It was a race. It was a race, and everybody was in the race but black folk. Black folk never participated in the race. You were the prize, the boot, the loot that they used to empower themselves. See, they were buying blacks in Africa on a typical for $15 to $20 a piece. And they established a thing called a profit margin, 15% return on investment, 1,500% return. So they were selling for $400 and $500 they got into the United States and to other countries. And that's why the whole banking system started off of slavery in Portugal. Again, and the whole system of capitalism started off of black slavery. Before that was mercantilism. The whole concept that you all are playing in with promotions and what's called marketing development came out of black slavery. And it was designed not for you to profit, but for others to profit. Everybody was profiting initially except you, and it has not changed. And so when I look at your program, and it says that you are marketing developers. I would say marketing means going into any environment, a site, a geographical area, and promoting a product or a service or a good to get an equal value for it. You're marketing. But it also stipulates in there that to be a marketer, you must have a market. So I ask black folk, where are your markets? Where are your markets? Where is the black market? And they said, well, Dr. Evans, we got a black market. Where is it? They said, well, it's all over the United States. And that's how much you get. Well, we got a $650 billion black market. And that's a lot of money. Wrong is not. It is not a lot of money. It's only a lot of money when it's aggregated. Scattered through the integration process, your money is nothing. It is chump change. Because we don't plan to have power. That's why we continue to integrate and scatter our money. And then brag about how much money we got. And then we come up with magazines and research to tell everybody where to go get our money and how to get it. Nobody else is that foolish but us. You got to have a license to be that stupid to do those kind of games. You don't tell people how to come into your market and how to sell to your people and take your money and your economy out. That's called a capital drain. When I was Assistant Secretary in Commerce, we would take I took trade missions around the world. Nobody would allow that to happen in their country. We would not let the Japanese come over here and do dumpings. Dump their automobiles in Norfolk and in Jacksonville, Florida. That's called dumping, which means you come over and take the wealth out of our nation and doesn't take anything back to Japan. When they come over and dump their steel from Korea, we had a balance of trade policy, so you can't do this. Everybody has a balance of trade policy except black folk. We'll let anybody come in and do anything to us because we haven't changed since slavery. We still don't understand the process. Every day, Burger King's and McDonald's trucks will come into a black neighborhood and dump hamburgers, Coca-Cola, and take nothing out. That's a balance of trade deficit. This country right now is suffering from a balance of trade because we've allowed it to happen since Bush has been in office. And that's why you cannot profit in the society, because you got a capital drain. Nobody's ever taught black folk how to practice group economics. Your money is supposed to stay in your own country or in your own community and with your own hands and your own people and bounce at least 8 to 12 times. But we are the only people that absolutely refuse to do it. We won't do it. As a matter of fact, we are against spending money with our own people. And we're in that condition because Meritorious Manumission taught us in 1710 that a policy was set up in the Virginia colony and then also later into South Carolina. It's called Meritorious Manumission. Meritorious means to earn. Manumission means to release. So a black could earn his release from slavery if he did one of four things, or a combination, elaboration, or sophistication of those four things. One, if he could prove to whites that he could see things through the eyes of a white person, and he'd prove it by one, saving a white person's life; two, saving a white person's property; three, inventing something or improving the profits that he gets from picking cotton and corn or tobacco; or four, if he would squeal on and tell on any other black person who was trying to escape from slavery. That was called meritorious manumission. We still got blacks in America that's working hard and diligently to get meritorious manumission. They're working hard to make sure that they protect a white person's property. I don't care, and they protect it by any time you come out with an affirmative action program. I have the dubious honor of being the person who wrote that first affirmative action plan for the state of Florida in 1971 that went all over the country, a comprehensive plan. I didn't write the plan for minorities, poor folk, Asians, Hispanics, Arabs, midgets, humpbacks, lesbians. I wrote it for black folk. But immediately the whole frame of reference is the way you keep black folk down is always to loot and water something and make pretend it's for everybody. And that way anything for everybody is for nobody. And so they took that minority program, the affirmative action program, made it a minority program. And see, now I want the affirmative action program to die for that reason. In 1999, I go down to Texas, and a program is written for black folk. I look at the amount of money in state contracts in Texas that year, and white women got 78%. And nobody in our black leadership, in our black overclass, in the black civil rights movement ever said, hold a second, how are you going to put white women into a minority, into an affirmative action program set up for black folk when she was right along with the white man? She co-owned, co-controlled, co-influenced, co-inherited, and everything that the white slave owner had, she had it too. She sat in the same house, under the same table, slept in the same bed, and raised his kids. How is she entitled to be competitive with black men or black people in the society? But our black leadership didn't say anything, so white women went into the affirmative action program and took it over and dominated it. That's why you go to check Coca-Cola about 3 years ago. Coca-Cola Company, almost 66% of all the money on a minority program went to white women. And in Texas, white women got 78%, and Hispanics got 21%, and blacks got 0.9%. Because, again, we don't know how to play the game. We keep buying into these myths about these very broad, ambiguous groupings. And all of that stuff started immediately after the Civil War. See, the Civil War, what they never tell you, and when I'm coming to a point on this with immigration, that in 1865, the first civil rights law was written strictly and solely for black folk to reverse the Dred Scott decision, which says black people don't have any rights that anybody's bound to respect. So they wrote the Civil Rights Law of 1865 strictly and solely for black people. And Andrew Johnson vetoed it, and they came right back, a few liberal whites, and they wrote the 1866 Civil Rights Law. Again, said it's strictly for black folk. And the Civil Rights Law had nothing in the world to do what you talk about today about civil rights. That Civil Rights Law was written for three things, and Congressman Benjamin Hatch and Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens, and what they said is this, that there's only two things that the black person could ever be in America. You're either going to be slaves or you're going to be free. But you will always be a slave in America unless the black person receives minimally 40 acres, a mule, and $100. And you never got it. Because and so that you tells you where you are now. Nothing has changed for you. And so in 1868, they passed the 14th Amendment. It says, well, at least if you're not going to give black folks something, you need to protect black folks' rights. And the law then said it is mandated upon all levels of government to use all necessary means to lift the badges and incidents of slavery off the shoulders of black folk. Nobody has done it. That is a law. And at that time, the civil rights law said if you don't do it and you're in government, you go straight to jail, white or black. Nobody has carried out those civil rights laws to the present time. They were written for black folk. The 14th Amendment says that black folk must be treated in a manner similar to the way whites are treated under equal circumstances, similar circumstances. And in 1873, some whites from New Orleans went to file a lawsuit to use the 14th Amendment in the slaughterhouse case about the meat packers out in New Orleans. And in 1873, the United States Supreme Court came back and says whites cannot use those civil rights laws and cannot use the 14th Amendment because it was written strictly and solely to protect the rights and the freedoms of black people, people of African descent in America. When they said that in 1873, immediately the whole country exploded. And then the executive branch, the government, the judiciary with the courts, and the Congress got together and says, we got to end this right now. Because if black folk get smart and started using the civil rights laws and started using the 14th Amendment and started looking out strictly for themselves, they can be self-sufficient and competitive as a people. And they say, what we got to do now is to broaden and whiten those laws and pretend those laws were written for everybody. And if they're written for everybody, then black folk can't use them. See, that's how Barkey came up in 1968 and used the 14th Amendment. And the medical school exams say that it was a reverse discrimination against him. That's why you see all these reverse discrimination court suits all over the country, because black folk now have walked away from their rights. You see, anytime you want to be a minority, a poor person, or people of color, or diversity, multicultural, you walked away from your rights. You're not entitled to any benefits. You cannot justify having an affirmative action program, having a Black History Month, having reparations for black folk if you're using those very broad terms. Because the minute you say you're a people of color or you're a minority or you're diverse, what you're saying, there's no difference in the treatment of a black person in this country than an Eskimo or a Filipino just came in last week. And if there's no difference, then how are you going to demand something special or exception? How are you going to demand having a special week for black history? How are you going to demand to have reparations and affirmative action? When you go into the marketplace as a developer, promoter, you are not entitled to anything because you keep using the terms that says you're not anything different from anyone else. If your company is talking about diversity and multicultural and the minorities, you cannot justify going into the black community and looking for black consumers or having black dollars specifically set aside for black folk. You just wiped out your whole history, all the history and the mistreatment and the slavery of your own people and ancestors by saying, I'm a minority. And if I'm a minority, I'm no different from anyone else. And so my people have never learned how to play the game. They keep going into the marketplace in a very broad, ambiguous terms, the concept that was used after the Civil War. And that's why we now keep talking about minorities. And so now we got a major problem in society that's going to wipe us out, immigrants coming into society. Because in 1970, for the first time, after the Civil Rights Movement was over, and there were some benefits coming to the table for black folk, those other groups figured it out. They figured out what my people hadn't figured out. See, because up to 1970, all the Arabs in this country, all the Hispanics in this country, they had, and then Asians in this country, they had been living with, marrying, and going to school with whites. On their driver's license, their immigration papers, they were classified as whites. But after the Civil Rights Act in 1970 and all these benefits, affirmative action came to the table, they say all we got to do is to break away from the people we've been getting benefits from and go against black folk. Now all these immigrants are coming out. They started in the 1970 census. They're now competing against black folk for resources. And they're going to wipe you out. Your leadership will not support you. They're all supporting more immigrants coming into the country. They're down on the border saying, y'all, come on, come on. And they don't understand. Let me give you a couple of points in them, and I'm going to give you some strategies we're going to have to start using. They don't understand that for every 10% increase in immigrants into this country, the people that are hurt are primarily black folk. White corporations benefit, black folks suffer. For every 10% increase in immigrants in this country, black people lose 0.3% of their income. I'm going to give it to you again. For every 10% increase in immigrants coming into this country, it's been going on throughout society for over 100 years, black folk lose 0.3% of their income. Now, since 1970 alone in this country, when I just told you, when all of a sudden these groups broke out, they figured they can go to the United States now and get all kind of benefits. All they got to do is put one foot on the shore of America, and they're now entitled, they're now equal to black folk. They're equal to 400 years of suffering by black folk by just putting one foot in the United States. They're now entitled to go into affirmative action programs, get Social Security benefits, and get a free education and everything else. So since 1970 until the present time, the immigrants in this country have gone up over 400%. Now, if you multiply 400 times 0.3, it comes out to be 12%. Now, what's the impact of that? You go back and look at your census. You find out in 1950 when the Civil Rights Movement started, and it started over this issue, that black folk were being underpaid. At that time in 1950, a typical white person in the United States was making $1. A black person was making 54 cents. That meant that a black person with a college education could not make as much as a white high school dropout. So a black person earned 54 cents to every dollar the white was earning. Now, because of the Civil Rights Movement, black folk then got some new opportunities going into government jobs and some white corporations. So our income went up during the 60s from 54 cents up to 66 cents against a white dollar. By 1976, we went back from 66 cents back to 54 cents where we are now. Your entire civil rights gains in income was wiped out by immigrants coming into the country. Nobody's going to tell you that, but we're going to tell you through our think tank. Your whole income has been wiped out, and now the gap between the wealthy and this country is widening. The poverty rate is increasing, and most damagingly on blacks. So not only have you lost your income during the civil rights movement, let me show you else what you lost. The number of people coming into the country, just black folk during that time, were struggling for voters' rights. They were being shot, lynched, whipped, and beaten, and bummed all through the South just for the right to go to the polls and vote. You just lost your voting power in this country. The immigrants wiped out your voting power. Your whole civil rights movement was a waste of time now, and those deaths were useless, futile. When in 1970, we outnumbered Hispanics, as an example, 2-1. They have now caught you and passed you. I predicted that in my first book, Black Labor, White Wealth. They'll catch you in the year 2000. They caught you exactly in the year 2000, right on the money. They now got 42 million in the country. You got 36 million. They can now outvote you on anything they want and block you on anything you want in the country. Now we got 14 to 20 million immigrants floating around this country, undocumented illegals, that the Congress is planning on giving amnesty to because white corporations want the cheap labor. Black folk are an obsolete labor class. They want some new labor. And so what they're going to do now is give them amnesty to 14 to 20 million. You add that 14 to 20 million to the 42 million you already got. That takes them up to almost 60 million Hispanics then in the country. Now, based on the 1986 immigration law, they then got a right to bring in their spouses, their children, and their parents. And we estimate that they'll bring in another 35 million Hispanics. They will then have 90 million to your 36. They will outnumber you 3-1 within 10 years. If you couldn't outvote whites, you haven't got a snowball's chance of outvoting Hispanics alone. Your vote was neutralized a long time ago. When I was running political campaigns for presidents back in 84 and for Carter in 76, and I ran in Atlanta, Georgia in 88, and again for Clinton's deputy political strategy in 92, I knew then that the black vote was gone and dead. See, whites alone outnumber you 8-1. That means 8 will go over 1 at least 8 times with nothing left over. Your vote is only important in the power economics principle when you vote as a majority. You must be the majority population. You cannot integrate and get economic power. You cannot integrate and get voting power. You must always try to figure out how to come together and aggregate to get your power. If you don't come together and become the majority population, your vote means nothing. If I throw a rabbit into a pen with 800 bulldogs, the rabbit can vote all he wants about what they're going to have for dinner.
Okay, everybody, we back. Dr. Claude Anderson, and that was Understanding the Game. So you know what you're up against and what you need to be doing. Number one, that was when he done that and when he done those lectures and speeches, that was yesterday. So we can imagine what kind of position that we are in today, because we got more and more people being incarcerated, and they've gotten to the point now where you go into their courtroom and they just overrule anything. They just lock them up, you know. You know, out there on the streets, in the street, they just beat a woman down, just shoot you, just kill you. To the point because you have not taken control of your situation collectively as a nation. We have sit down and haven't done anything to strengthen our position. We haven't understood what took place. We, in order to understand that, we need to go back to the beginning. We need to listen to Brother Malcolm X. We need to listen to what Farrakhan have to say. The Grand National Chairman, Elihu Pleasant Bay. We need to listen to the elders about the beginning so that we can get in a position to make some changes, but it's going to have to start in our own minds. In order for us to survive this thing, we're going to have to get in a position where we change our mind. We're going to have to stop doing some of the things that we're doing. Party time is over. We've been in America long enough for us to have done something, but we haven't thing. We haven't realized what we are supposed to do. We haven't done any research. We've always relied on somebody else to do something. Let me explain something to you about a democratic situation. You cannot survive as a Democrat. And I want to explain to you what I mean by that, is relying on somebody to give you something, or relying on the government to take care of you. You can't survive like that. You can only survive in a republic situation or an independent situation where you take personal responsibility for yourself. You're not waiting on anything to happen. You're going to make something happen. You ain't asking for freedom, justice, and equality in America. You're going to take it. And whatever you see that's affecting your community, you need to do something about it. You ain't got to get loud. You ain't got to get threatening. You ain't got to do none of that. You're more effectively if you're quiet. One of the most effective and powerful things that the devil has done is lead us to believe that there's no such thing as the devil. Same thing with the mafia. They was made millions, hundreds of millions, of billions and billions of dollars. But they had a thing called La Cosa Nostra, which means everybody, the rules are everybody keep their mouth shut. And everybody is to, any statement is there is no such thing as the mafia. And anybody who say it is, we're going to kill them. That was what's going on. But we do things differently. We want to raise fans. We want to talk noise. We want to hoop and holler and let everybody know where they're. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. You can't do that, man. You can't do that. Whatever it is you're going to do, do it. But keep your mouth shut. Be quiet about it. And do what you have to do. Once you understand what the problem is, then you set out to correct it. I didn't say nothing about making an announcement about nothing. We got to do some changing about our thinking, and in order to get out, you can get out. We got a lot of things at our disposal. First of all, you are a spiritual being having a human experience, and when you begin to study the teachings of your own ancestors and learn everything about you and about your ancient culture. And I know you married to a Puerto Rican sister. I know you're a brother. You got a Caucasian wife and all that's fine. Okay, you got that. That's you're too late. Been there. You got that. You done that. But my question is, what is it that you know about yourself and your culture and your ancient culture? Because if you got this stuff in your mind about we're going to succeed nationally being multicultural, Dr. Claude Anderson just told you, you ain't going to make it. That does not work. In order for you to have any power, your power base, the foundation of your power, has to be your knowledge of your own self, your ancient culture. Now, I ain't talking about slavery. We got to go past that. That ain't our history. That's an incident that happened yesterday. That ain't had nothing. That pales totally into a total insignificance when you understand the magnificence and grandeur and the power and the great things that you and your ancestors have done on this planet. That is what you study. So that you can get, you can't wait for somebody to bring up a lie so you can correct it. Or you can't wait for somebody to ask you who you are so that you can tell them. You can't wait to do that. And the only way you can do that is you're going to have knowledge of self. You got churches all over the United States. Out in front of the churches, they got a sign that tell you the name of the church, Sunday school, the time the church is open, and the days and the times. And then they have this scripture down there. The thing is, there's only one saying that went throughout the entire ancient culture of what they're calling today, which is no such place, Egypt. There's no such place. But in ancient Kemet, there was only one saying, man, know thyself. Now, that's power. First thing you want to have power. So before you can communicate with anybody, the first thing you got to know is something about your own self. How are you going to expect to be able to do anything with any real power when you don't even know who you are? How? You can't. There are people who will lead you to believe that you're going somewhere and you got something, as long as you don't learn about who you are. You got people who are actually invest in you and take you away from your people and put you over here in a nice little protective bubble and give you anything you want, as long as you don't unite with your people. Just think about it for a moment. President Obama is coming to Jacksonville. Okay, the president coming to Jacksonville. They're broadcasting it on the news. But when President Obama step off a plane, there are people that's waiting on him. They're going to take him. They're going to put him in a motorcade, and they're going to drive him right straight past the majority of people who look like him. All the way over there in a place where everybody over there don't look like him. And if you do have some over there, they have a brain with the people who don't look like him in it. And then after he gets through speaking and doing all the things he got to get do, he put back on in the motor cave and sent right to the plane and whisk out the city. Never did see him. You over there, you got a predominantly brothers and sisters in their community, and the news broadcasting them, Obama coming to town. But you'll never see it. And if you get caught going over there in the area where he at, so you can tell him about your condition and get him to come over in the community so you can see the discrimination of your city and see how the wealth is in the hands of only a few. You'll be incarcerated, accused of being a terrorist, and shut down. And locked up, and even killed. And this kind of thing is going on all across the United States. Anybody that's famous or get any kind of power or wealth or influence are never allowed to come over there where you at. And if he is some kind of way, he's surrounded by people. I remember one time in the same place that I told you about earlier, in the Prime Osborne, the sister that played on Different Strokes, the cop's wife, beautiful sister, she come to the Prime Osborne. And as waiters, we had the setup in the back of everybody out in front. We will serve them, and we'll go around the side, and we will clean off the dishes and put them in the trays and stuff behind the scenes. And everybody would walk out. But the sister came on, gave a beautiful presentation, and the whole audience was filled with Caucasian people when she come to town. Nobody knew she was in town. None of the so-called black community, nobody. And it was only, I think you might can count the amount of people of African descent that was in the audience to even see the sister when she came to town. But after it was over with, the sister, she recognized what had taken place. She didn't see her people. And she says, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes what I have to say. And she just turned around and began to walk off the stage. She was supposed to go off to the right because all the men was to the right. But she turned her bodyguards was to the right. But she turned around and began to walk off to the left. In other words, she was flipping the script on everybody. And when she walked off to the left, the bodyguard scurried across the stage and began to follow her. She bent the corner, came around the back, and there we were, all of her people. She knew we was back there because we were the ones serving everybody, but we was not allowed to be in the audience to say anything to her, enjoy what she had to say, even though we heard everything she said because it was loudspeakers. But the bodyguards run back there. Here come all the building security. The police, all the Caucasians run back. She said, get out of the way. Get out of the way. Don't touch me. Told them all. She said, I want to shake my people's hand. And she come down the line. She said, I want everybody to line up. And it was a whole pile of us back there. And she shake everybody's hand. She said, thank you. The meal was good. And thank you. And all the way across the board. And I admire that sister for that. And she's a very attractive woman, too. She looked better in person than she did on TV. But you see, in this society, in order to have some power, you need to learn everything you can about yourself. You got power. I mean, I know you're trying to figure out, how that works. You try it and see. Because you have to remember the old saying, what goes in will come out. the mouth can only speak what the heart is full of. But if you have allowed somebody to tell you that you got some power because you went to Harvard or Cambridge or Yale and all that, you have been deceived. You can't pull a wagon unless you got the horse in front of the wagon. Because the first thing you're supposed to be taught in any college or university or junior high school or kindergarten is who you are. And once you find out who you are, now you're officially ready to learn something about ABCs. But the first thing you got to be taught is who you are. And that's what's missing. And when you get in your in your schools, if you first of all, this got to start in the house. You get this down in the house, and then when you're taking the kindergarten, I think the parents should let the kindergarten teacher know what you already been teaching them. And they should just say, well, look, I'll be back next week to see your agenda so you to make sure that you going along with what we're supposed to do. What child has already been, because see, all this other stuff you got in here about Addison, Jerry, and Spot, and the only thing that my child can identify with is the spot that's on the door, we got a problem. Because they ain't going for that. Because they already know who they are. We need you to be consistent with that first. So with that foundation, now you're officially ready to go. Because I'm trying to figure out how is it possible for me to go inside a courtroom and a judge, a Caucasian judge, start giving me some orders about anything. I'm trying to figure out how that goes. You don't have a history. You're an immigrant. You're a grown woman in this land. Now, I hate to get crunk up about this here, but let me provide you with the facts. You come in here tomorrow, bring let's pass this case to tomorrow. You go in here and you bring me all the facts and prove to me beyond any shadow of a doubt that you got an ancient history. And I guarantee you I can bring documentation and prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that you don't. Now, I'm not telling nobody to go out there and do that, but I'm just letting you know if you got knowledge yourself, because anytime you sit across the table and you're a man of African descent and you sitting across the table from somebody that don't look like you, you both can be speaking the same language. You both can be talking about the same subject. But I can assure you that you should be both talking from two different world views. Now, when it comes to slavery and all that stuff, that's something that happened during our lifetime. But you should study the great magnificence of your ancient ancestors so you would know about the pyramids in the Americas and the original owners of the landmass that they are calling North America, and the great magnificent exploits that you've done in South America, and the ancient history of the real Jerusalem, and who the real Jews are, and who the real Yahshua is, instead of this stuff that we be hearing about a man named Jesus. How is it possible for there to be someone named Jesus when the alphabet J wasn't added to the English language until the middle or latter half of the 16th century? And when you have these facts and you got this evidence, now you will be like a man who's all dressed up and know where to go, because ain't nobody that don't look like you about to challenge you about anything. Not even any Asian man. I had an Asian man where, the so-called Indians in America, these are ancestors. I said, well, you got your blood in them. I have to agree with that. I said, but who do you think is the oldest people on in the Americas? Who was the oldest people on this landmass that you call America? Well, I have to go. Excuse me a minute. I have to go. I said, well, I'll wait till you come back. I'll wait. Okay, Mo. Now, I hate to get crunk up about this stuff, but I'm just trying to tell you, because one of the most dangerous men in America is a self-educated man and a man who have knowledge of self. You ain't got to run your mouth about a whole lot of stuff. You can spot a lie a mile away and dissect it. And you discover that a whole lot of people don't even want to look you in the eye when you start telling the truth. And you don't ever want to tell the truth that you don't have the facts to back up from many different angles. We go out, we celebrate Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving. We just got through. I was sitting out in my front yard, and I know the people in my immediate area, they had to spend at least $50,000 on explosives. And I'm, you know, they said more than that. And my question is, for what? Now, I can see if you had invested in a 15,000 50 caliber rifles and 250,000 rounds of ammunition, and then I didn't hear nail firecracker. Oh, man, it would have been on and popping then if I could have got it like that.
To understand this, you have to go back to what young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food, what he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, "We got a good house here," the house Negro said, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick. We sick." He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, "Let's run away, let's escape, let's separate," that house Negro would look at you and say, "Man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this?" That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, "I'm the only Negro out here." "I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You nothing but a house Negro." And if someone come to you right now and say, "Let's separate," you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. "What you mean separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa." That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa. On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field than there was Negroes in the house. The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog.
The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were, guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are all still gut eaters. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes. And he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated the master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masses are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts. Our Navy. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day used Tom, the house Negro, to keep the field Negroes in check, the same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Toms, 20th century Uncle Toms, to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful and nonviolent. That's Tom making you nonviolent. It's like when you go to the dentist and the man is going to take your tooth. You're going to fight him when he starts pulling. So they squirt some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine to make you think they're not doing anything to you. So you sit there and because you got all that Novocaine in your jaw, you suffer peacefully. Blood running all down your jaw. And you don't know what's happening. Because someone has taught you to suffer peacefully. The white man do the same thing to you in the street. When he gonna want to put knots on your head and take advantage of you and don't have to be afraid of you fighting back. To keep you from fighting back, he get these old religious Uncle Toms to teach you and me that just like Novocaine, suffer peacefully. Don't stop suffering, just suffer peacefully. As Reverend Cleve pointed out, let your blood flow in the streets. This is a shame. And you know he's a Christian preacher. If it's a shame to him, you know what it is to me. Because nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send him to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that all-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's a good religion. And then anybody, no one resents that kind of religion being taught but a wolf who intends to make you his meal. This is the way it is with the white man in America. He's a wolf, and you a sheep. Anytime a shepherd, a pastor, teach you and me not to run from the white man, and at the same time teachers don't fight the white man, he's a traitor to you and me. Don't lay down our life all by itself. No. Preserve your life. It's the best thing you got. And if you got to give it up, let it be even Stephen. The slave master took Tom and dressed him well and fed him well and even gave him a little education. Gave him a long coat and a top hat and made all the other slaves look up to him. Then he used Tom to control them. The same strategy that was used in those days is used today by the same white man. He take a Negro, so-called Negro, and make him prominent. Build him up. Publicize him. Make him a celebrity. And then he becomes a spokesman for Negro and a Negro leader. I would like to just mention one thing else quickly, and that is the method that the white man uses, how the white man uses these big guns or Negro leaders against the black revolution. They are not a part of the black revolution. They're used against the black revolution. When Martin Luther King failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia, the civil rights struggle in America reached its low point. King became bankrupt almost as a leader. Plus, even financially, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was in financial trouble. Plus, it was in trouble, period, with the people when they failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia. Other Negro civil rights leaders of so-called national stature became fallen idols. As they became fallen idols, begin to lose their prestige and influence, local Negro leaders begin to stir up the masses. In Cambridge, Maryland, Gloria Richardson. In Danville, Virginia, and other parts of the country, local leaders begin to stir up our people at the grassroots level. This was never done by these Negroes whom you recognize of national stature. They controlled you, but they never incited you or excited you. They controlled you. They contained you. They kept you on the plantation. As soon as King failed in Birmingham, Negroes took to the streets. King got out and went out to California to a big rally and raised about, I don't know how many thousands of dollars. Come to Detroit and had a march and raised some more thousands of dollars. And recall, right after that, Wilkins attacked King. Accused King and the Corps of starting trouble everywhere and then making the NAACP get him out of jail and spend a lot of money. And then he accused King and Corps of raising all the money and not paying it back. This happened. I got it in documented evidence in the newspaper. Roy started attacking King, and King started attacking Roy, and Farmer started attacking both of them. And as these Negroes of national stature begin to attack each other, they begin to lose their control of the Negro masses. And Negroes was out there in the streets. They was talking about, we're going to march on Washington. By the way, right at that time, Birmingham had exploded, and the Negroes in Birmingham, remember, they also exploded. They began to stab the crackers in the back and bust them upside the head. Yes, they did. That's when Kennedy sent in the troops down in Birmingham. So, and right after that, Kennedy got on the television and said, this is a moral issue. That's when he said he's going to put out a civil rights bill. And when he mentioned civil rights bill and the Southern crackers start talking about they were going to boycott it or filibuster it, then the Negroes start talking about what? We're going to march on Washington, march on the Senate, march on the White House, march on the Congress and tie it up, bring it to a halt. Don't let the government proceed. They even said they were going to go out to the airport and lay down on the runway and don't let no airplanes land. I'm telling you what they said. That was revolution. That was revolution. That was the black revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. Scared the white man to death. Scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there. When they found out that this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol, they called in Wilkins. They called in Randolph. They called in these national Negro leaders that you respect and told them, call it off. Kennedy said, look, y'all letting this thing go too far. And old Tom said, boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it. I'm telling you what they said. They said, I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it. They said, these Negroes are doing things on their own. They're running ahead of us. And that old shrewd fox, he said, well, if you all aren't in it, I'll put you in it. I'll put you at the head of it. I'll endorse it. I'll welcome it. I'll help it. I'll join it. A matter of hours went by. They had a meeting at the Carlisle Hotel in New York City. The Carlisle Hotel is owned by the Kennedy family. That's the hotel Kennedy spent the night at two nights ago. Belongs to his family. A philanthropic society headed by a white man named Stephen Currier called all the top civil rights leaders together at the Carlisle Hotel and told them that by you all fighting each other, you're destroying the civil rights movement. And since you're fighting over money from white liberals, let us set up what's known as the Council for United Civil Rights Leadership. Let's form this council, and all the civil rights organizations will belong to it, and we'll use it for fundraising purposes. Let me show you how tricky the white man is. And as soon as they got it formed, they elected Whitney Young as the chairman. And who you think became the co-chairman? Stephen Currier, the white man. A millionaire. Powell was talking about it down at the Cobo today. This is what he was talking about. Powell knows it happened. Randolph knows it happened. Wilkins knows it happened. King knows it happened. Every one of that so-called Big Six, they know what happened. Once they formed it, with the white man over it, he promised them and gave them $800,000 to split up between the Big Six and told them that after the march was over, they'd give them $700,000 more. $1.5 million split up between leaders that you've been following, going to jail for, crying crocodile tears for. And they've nothing but Frank James and Jesse James and brothers. Soon as they got the setup organized, the white men made available to them top public relations experts. Opened the news media across the country at their disposal. And then they begin to project these Big Six as the leaders of the march, Originally, they weren't even in the march. You was talking this march talk on Hastings Street. Is Hastings Street still here? On Hastings Street. You was talking the march talk on Lenox Avenue. And down on, what you call it, Fillmore Street. And Central Avenue. And 42nd Street and 63rd Street. That's where the march talk was being talked. But the white man put the big six ahead of it. Made them the march. They became the march. They took it over. And the first move they made after they took it over, they invited Walter Reuther, a white man. They invited a priest, a rabbi, and an old white preacher. Yes, an old white preacher. The same white element that put Kennedy in power, labor, the Catholics, the Jews, and liberal Protestants. Same clique that put Kennedy in power joined the March on Washington. It's just like when you got some coffee that's too black, which means it's too strong. What you do? You integrate it with cream. You make it weak. If you pour too much cream in, you won't even know you ever had coffee. It used to be hot, it becomes cool. It used to be strong, it becomes weak. It used to wake you up, now it'll put you to sleep. This is what they did with the March on Washington. They joined it. They didn't integrate it. They infiltrated it. They joined it. Became a part of it. Took it over. And as they took it over, it lost its militancy. They ceased to be angry. They ceased to be hot. They ceased to be uncompromising. Why, it even ceased to be a march. It became a picnic, a circus. Nothing but a circus. With clowns and all. You had one right here in Detroit. I saw it on television. With clowns leading it. White clowns and black clowns. I know you don't like what I'm saying, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Because I can prove what I'm saying. If you think I'm telling you wrong, you bring me Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph and James Farmer and those other three. And see if they'll deny it over the microphone. No, it was a sellout. It was a takeover. When James Baldwin came in from Paris, they wouldn't let him talk because they couldn't make him go by the script. Bert Lancaster read the speech that Baldwin was supposed to make. They wouldn't let Baldwin get up there because they know Baldwin liable to say anything. They controlled it so tight, they told those Negroes what time to hit town, how to come. Where to stop? What sign to carry? What song to sing? What speech they could make and what speech they couldn't make? And then told them to get out of town by sundown. And every one of those Toms were out of town by sundown. Now I know you don't like my saying this. But I can back it up. It was a circus, a performance. It beat anything Hollywood could ever do. The performance of the year. Reuther and those other three devils should get a Academy Award for the best actors because they acted like they really loved Negroes and fooled a whole lot of Negroes. And the six Negro leaders should get an award, too, for the best supporting cast.
Okay, Mo, there you have it. A lot of us might disagree with that, or we might not like what Brother Malcolm said. But we just have to remember one thing. It is the truth that sets you free, not a lie. The truth. You always want to ferret out the truth. find the truth and tell the truth. I don't see why that's so hard, because I know sisters, and I have every house that I went to throughout my life. I don't ever recall a sister instilling in her children to lie. I've always heard them tell their children over and over, always tell the truth. But I think what emphasis need to be put on the truth is when you are telling the truth, make sure that you have the facts to back up the truth that you're telling, and be prepared to tell the truth by any means necessary. We got to get over this thing about fear. We have to understand that if we are spiritual beings having a human experience, I have to understand why you. I have to say I do understand why we think the things that we think, because we are forgetting, or we're not paying attention a lot of times. Because I remember, my mother. She told me, she said, my mother visited me tonight. And that was my grandmama. And I know my grandmama had passed on. And she would tell me things like, well, my mama visited me all the time. And then I hear brothers, older people to say, well, this baby right here, I know who this baby is. This baby ain't nobody but your granddaddy. And he done came back, and because he act just like him. And he just like him. I know him when I see him. I know who he is. And he's an old soul to come and go. And we do. We come and go all the time. So we have this, we be having this fear of death. We got to get over that. Because that's something that people are capitalizing on. The fact that I can scare you and you be scared. And as a result of being afraid, you won't do anything. We got to get past that. In my opinion, if you're afraid to die, then you haven't even begun to live yet. You got to get rid of that. When you get rid of that and you replace fear, and the best way to get rid of fear is to replace fear with skill. But just think about it for a minute. You become a master of the use of physical combat, hand-to-hand. You become a master of the use of handling a knife and throwing a knife. These are things that you can practice and become skilled at. You become skilled at using a .45. You become skilled at the use of a high-powered rifle from great distances. You become skilled at cooking, cleaning. You become skilled at growing your own food. You know what I found out? I know for those of us who have read the Bible, we heard the term a husbandman. A husbandman, the definition for that is a farmer. A farmer. And then I read about the story about, because I was trying to find out, where did the mafia come from? And I found out that these particular Italians were farmers. And they dealt with fertilizers. And fertilizers can be used to make explosives with. Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, they were masters of explosives, and they blew up the federal building using ammonium nitrate and diesel fuel. The combination was just right. Magnificent explosive. And ammonium nitrate is fertilizer. You could go to Walmart and say, I need a bag of ammonium nitrate. As long as you don't say, I need two pallets of ammonium nitrate. You do that, they call it the feds. But these people were farmers, and they were being oppressed by the Italian government. And it's the same thing that's happening to us today, how we're being policed, we're being beaten and shot in the streets and in jails and all of this stuff. But what these people done is they began to depend on their skill, their hunting skill, their growing of their own food, their making of their own explosives and stuff. And then the mafia and the secret societies were formed. These farmers beat their plowshares, pruning hooks, into knives and swords. And they removed the oppression of their government away from them. And they said, well, hell, this is working. We might as well become the mafia. But go check the story out for yourself, and you discover that he was farmers. Abraham, in your Bible, when they kidnapped Lot, Abraham didn't call the police. Abraham gathered up the men of his house, and he was a husbandman. He was a farmer. He was skilled. He knew how to hunt, trap, and fish. These were field men. You know, when it comes to brothers, they call them field niggers and house niggers and all this stuff. My grandfather, the men at the company that he worked in Pulpwood, all the men had respect for him. And the Caucasian that owned the thing, he understood that. And he went and bought him a brand new Model T Ford when it first came out. And he brought it to the Pulpwood Company, and he wanted to share his power and authority and to show his goodwill toward his so-called slaves by letting one of the slaves take a ride in the automobile. And this will show to all the other slaves that master, all right. But he didn't pick a house nigger. He picked my grandfather. And when my grandfather pulled off the lot with the car, he turned the corner, and he never seen him again. He never seen that car again. My grandfather went straight over there and picked up my grandmama, throwing the little rocks against the window. Come on, come on, come on. I want to show you something. He got in that car, and he stole her from my great-great-granddaddy. And rode through three states. He was a house. He was a field, you know what? But my great-great-granddaddy was a bigger one. He got a house back. Got it up 50 men. Said, we're going to get him because he done stole my baby. But then he turned around and stopped at the gate. He said, y'all get off your horses. He said, I'm going to get the lightning by myself. Both of these men were hunters, master fishermen, master trappers and cold-blooded killers. And he caught them. By the time he caught them, she was pregnant with my mama. He couldn't separate them with one hand and hold that shotgun in the other because he was going to kill my granddaddy for stealing his baby. He gave up, got on that horse, and went back in the woods and went on back to town. Went back where he came from. My mother was born, and after that, I was born. We all come from the field. We don't come from the house. So if you need to listen to a house, brother, I suggest you don't come back over here. There ain't nothing over here but grass. Grass, weeds, plants, vegetables, and guns, and the truth. We got truth over here, and we ain't scared of that. Because every time you fear a death, you know, the time you invest in that, you might as well be dead. You know, and for those of you who believe in the Bible and read the Bible, I plainly tell you, do not have fear. You know, that fear, you know, you get rid of that, replace fear with confidence. And you can only have that unless you have some skill. will get you some skill. You know, brothers, if you got a sister, one of the first things you need to tell your sister, you say you love her, well, teach her how to shoot. You might not be at the house. You might have a brother-in-law or something come up there. She'll call you on the phone and say, baby, we ain't it. This man tried to break in the house, but don't worry, I got it. They're taking him out of here now. They got a stretcher. He on the stretcher. She got to be able to, you know, I mean, if that's the better half, how better is she? You know, what she know how to do? You know, you know, you might go out in the woods and try to hunt and break your leg and they had to bring you back in the house and they got to nurse you back to health and all this stuff. Well, you know, the children might say, well, look, I'm hungry. My mama had to grab that high-powered rifle out and say, I'll be right back. She come back and throw that food on the table and fix it up and feed everybody, including you. And my granddaddy taught my grandmama how to shoot, how to hunt, how to fish, how to cook, how to sew, how to do everything, including how to whoop a man. He taught her everything. She was totally sufficient. She was the baby, but all of her elder sisters came to town. And when they moved to the town where she was here, where we are, come to find out that she was in charge of everybody. Everybody came to her for advice. And I never forget my aunt, the most notorious aunt I had, her name was Scarface. That was a real one. Aunt Ludell. Aunt Ludell beat the brakes off you. She told me, you know what? The reason why you know everything you know is because Willie Lightning taught you. She said, well, that's all right. Don't worry about it. Billy didn't teach you nothing. It was so funny. But anyway, that's what it's all about. Self-survival, self-independence. Stop. Take the time to learn how to do something. Learn how to grow your own food. They got all kind of little plans and stuff. Instead of you and your wife going out to the restaurant and spending $200 and having these $200, $300, $400, $500 birthday parties and all these celebrations and parties and junk. Take a little bit of that money and go to the gun range. Or you can go out there in the woods. Practice until you get it down to a science. You know, self-preservation is the first law of nature. We're facing an economic collapse inside the United States where you're going to need these skills. And if you ain't got them, you're going to have a problem. So it's best to have them. And a lot of people got a whole lot of fear. You got to get rid of that. You ain't gonna survive. You're gonna be a victim of circumstances. And there's only two types of people in the world, and those are controllers of circumstances and victims of circumstances. So which way you gonna be? Which way you gonna go? You got to prepare yourself now. I brought all the previous broadcasts on. You've listened to the shows. All the experts have told you that we are facing an economic collapse and other natural disasters that's already destined to strike. So now is the time to get in position. A lot of us might say, well, look, I can't afford to do that. I don't have the money. Well, you get out of some of the debt you're in. You know, get rid of some of these, count some of these contracts you're in. You can learn how to do that. Start there. And then go to something else. Now, you know, and I don't want to continue to, you know, mess up your day and stuff and be preaching this kind of stuff all the time, but I'm the 8th of this month, I turned 61 years old. I've had a good time. I've mastered the skills, been through it, done this right here, all these things I have done, and I'm surviving. And I'm telling you what it's going to take to survive, and I'm bringing all the experts on to back up everything that I'm saying. You know, and it doesn't have anything to do with who they are. You know, a lot of us might say, well, you know, I want nothing to do with the Muslims in the Nation of Islam. I don't like Farrakhan. I don't want nothing to do with the Moors. But hey, man, get past that. Get the truth. The truth sets you free. Regardless of who's telling it. It don't matter who's telling it. If it's true, hold on to that piece. Dump the rest. Don't let that stop you from getting the truth about a situation. Always get the truth. Get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. That's what you want to get. Always. Now, I'm going to take a little quick break, and I'm going to be right back. Y'all hold on. Something to say, now's the time to raise your hand. The number to dial into this broadcast is 310-982-4255. 4184. That's 310-982-4184. Okay? Now, when my grandfather and them drove that car down there, he must have had some pressure on him because, a brother ain't supposed to have been had no car. So what he did was he ditched the automobile. And I asked my mama, I said, well, what did he do with the car? She said, I don't know. And I thought about it for a long time. And one day, doing my research and my ancient story, and because my mama told me, my granddaddy used to read all the time. All they do is research and all that. And so I did the same thing. And I said, I wonder what he did with that car. And I said, God, show me what he did with that car. And I ain't get no answer. And one day I was sitting in the living room looking at TV, and they pulled a Model T Ford up at the St. John River. They said, we don't know where it came from. We don't know. And the area that they pulled it up in, it wasn't too far from the area where my mother was born, and I was born, and all of my brothers and sisters, and where we lived there for a long time. I said, okay. I said, thank you, Lord. I see what he did. I would have did the same thing. And we don't know it. And I mean, this car was in mint condition. And they were trying to figure out where it come from. All the tires was on, it went all beat up. None that this car was in mint condition, but it had been under the river for a long time. And they pulled it up. I said, okay, I see what you did. And I knew that was it. And I said, well, thank you, Lord. I certainly appreciate it. But you, your Creator will give you anything you're asking for if you ask him. Provided it's something right. You be careful too now. You ask and say, well, Lord, give me more patience. Look out, because you put you in a situation where you ain't got no business, nothing but have patience. You be so mad, don't be careful. The reason I know that, because I tried it one time. I was in a hurry. And I said, Lord, give me some patience. Boy, I stayed in that line for hours. And then when I got out the line, because I couldn't take it no more, I came back. I said, I was already out there listening. No, you got to get back at the end of the line. You got to have patience. I said, okay, I understand this now. I really do. So we have a tremendous amount of power still yet. But it changed our thinking. And the hair on top of your head, that's nine ether. That's the highest grade of hair on earth. That's an antenna. Tune in. Use it. You know, study it. Look at the teaching. I would like to tell you all, because we got a lot of new people here this evening, I need you to go and get a book. The name of this book is Of Water and the Spirit, by Maladoma Patrice Somme. Get that book and read that book. And in that book, you will see in my opinion, this is the full extent of the natural power you have as the rightful owners of the earth. Everything in it and everything on it belongs to you, just like Elijah Muhammad said it did. I'm not a Muslim. I'm not a member of the Nation of Islam, but I can recognize truth. I don't care who said it. So if it's the truth, the whole truth is nothing but the truth. And I don't want to water down nothing. But that book, Of Water and the Spirit, by Maladoma Patrice Somme. One more time. Of Water and the Spirit, by by Maladoma Patrice Somme. And read that word for word, page for page, cover to cover, and then you will know some things about the power that you have. Right there. No money, no nothing. Just long, naked power right between your ears, inside your brain, provided you're willing to study the ancient teachings of your own ancestors, because this is where this comes from you. If you stand to reason and just common sense, if you're the oldest people on earth, and that means that everything on here came from you. Now, when somebody else try to come up and plead, they supersede you, they are lying to you. It is your remains that's being found all over this planet. And 75% of what's being found is not even broadcast to you. They're finding ancient bones and artifacts and stuff in the United States that's never hit the media. They box it up, they put it in crates, take it to the Smithsonian Institute and put it on the shelf, because we cannot afford to let you know who you are. The United Nations slipped up and came out and labeled the people in Louisiana as the oldest people on earth, predating the ancient dynasties of Kemet. That's a mighty powerful stuff right there. So don't complain about what you ain't got in your condition. Get to work. Start reading. Knowledge of self is your power base. Start there. And then go on to the next thing. It's all involved in commerce and law. The original law is natural law. Where it come from? It came from you. Who is God? Your God is one and the same. Just going on back, just walk backwards in time. You understand it. What society had to do is get you to believe in something outside of yourself. That's what they had to do. And that's where you are today. You got to turn that around. A lot of stuff I'm saying may not make sense to you, but after you do the investigation, then you'll be able to do a whole lot of things for yourself. You'll understand. Okay? You get that knowledge down, you understand. But anyway, we have come to the close of the broadcast, and I really do hope that you've gotten something out of this. As far as I'm concerned, my people come first, and everybody else on the planet comes second. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and until next time, you all have a good evening. Bring it to me, bring your sweet.
yeah.